One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through.
Hi, I'm Lauren Letellier.
I'm Chris Atkins. We're volunteers at the Rojan Library.
And this is WGXC, Acre, Hudson, and Catskill.
The Chicago Trio Whirlpool aims to blur the lines between improvising and composing. We'll hear a track from their debut album on the next Deep Threes. Plus music from Suede Merritt, R. Millis, Amatron 7, Stavros Gasparatos, and the Bureau of Atomic Tourism. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Lennox Local in Lennox, Massachusetts. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
This is Timer with the WGXC News Update. Go to the newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. On Saturday, July 18th, protests in favor of the Black Lives Matter movement continued locally in Greenville and Pleasant Valley, and so did uglier counter-protests at the same location. In Greenville, over 100 protesters met at the town park and then marched a short ways to the smaller park across from Greenville Town Hall. There, about half as many counter-protesters yelled at them with many obscenities. Online threats preceded the demonstration, including one about putting a snowplow back on a truck for the event. Someone did just that, driving that snowplow in the hot July sun back and forth along Route 32 over and over again during the two-hour demonstration. Protesters did not stay near the counter-protest long, moving back to the town park, with both sides then trying to impress cars driving by with their messages. Here is a sample of some of the sounds of the Greenville protest that started at noon on July 18th.
You have white skin! Does your life not matter, child?
Black lives matter!
I agree. All lives.
Black lives matter!
But by saying one race matters...
What are you going to do, kids? Move to a black man?
There's nothing to talk about.
What are you talking about, man? Then why are you even here protesting? If we agree on everything, what are you doing?
Okay, let's all start with one. Tell us what's going on. Tell us what my kids went with.
Why don't you go to Chicago? Why don't you march in Chicago? Huh? Well, they're all getting
killed. We're going to start drama in a town that has no racism. There is no racism here.
You're the ignorant little girl right there. You're ignorant. Go to Chicago.
You're starting drama for no reason.
You're ignorant. You're all ignorant. I don't see any black people there. Where are they? The black people
black lives
are over
matter.
Here.
White. What are you talking about, man? And you're a grown man. What are you doing?
I'm doing is saying that there should be equality for all, and there isn't.
You think there's actually no racism in the world?
Thank you, veterans!
It's about love!
Then you should be carrying
the flag.
I just brought my love sign.
If it's about love, what should be carrying a sign that says all life matters?
I said love conquers all.
You should be supporting the Bible. You should be supporting God and country.
Yeah.
The Bible.
How are you?
This is veterans' war. Do you know that? This is veterans' war.
Also on July 18th, Caitlin Cordero reported for the Poughkeepsie Journal that there was also a clash between protesters and counter-protesters in Pleasant Valley in Dutchess County. One side chanted Black Lives Matter, while the other side shouted back All Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter. The side chanting about Black Lives had peacemakers in yellow vests throughout the crowd discouraging interactions with the opposing voices. Police made no arrests or reported any injuries, but Royal Parker, organizer of the Black Lives Matter rally, said five protesters suffered minor injuries. Police officers pulled the two sides apart when a man yelling All Lives Matter lunged into a group of opposing protesters. Then police put themselves between the two groups. Quote, I hope there's going to be some more understanding. People think that the Black Lives Matter and black rallies is just to tear up streets. I hope that they see that this is not what it is. I hope that they see that this is a peaceful movement, unquote, Parker said before the event. Quote, I really hope that this movement will be like the civil rights movement and can help generations to come, unquote. The Dutchess County, New York Conservative Party organized the other protest. Here's a bit of the audio from Cordero's Twitter feed of the clash between the two groups. Nora Mishinek from Columbia Green Media reports that state police say no law was broken when a Kinderhook couple waved a gun at protesters on July 11th. Quote, the gun in possession of the homeowners was legally possessed, and the incident, which was captured on video obtained by police, did not reveal any violation of law, unquote, state police said in a statement. Kinderhook Mayor James Dunham said July 17th that police extensively interviewed neighbors of the still unnamed couple who live on Rothermull Lane. The incident went viral on the internet last week when Hudson Mayor Kamal Johnson posted two videos online about the incident he witnessed. Johnson, who is African American, said he believed he would have been put in handcuffs and arrested if he waved a gun at a large crowd. The couple left with police 40 minutes after the incident without being placed in handcuffs. Read more about the story at HudsonValley360.com. Diane Valden reports in the Columbia paper that there is still not much to report in the assault of Harold Handy, the local auto mechanic, who was beat up at a party in Kinderhook in the early morning hours of July 5th. Alex and Kelly Briscoe Rosenstrock live at the home on County Route 21 where Handy was beaten. She is a Columbia County deputy sheriff, and he owns the Club Life Health and Fitness business in Valencia. Alex Rosenstrock is known for reopening his gym in defiance of COVID-19 New York State executive orders until it was shut down by officials. He has also made many political donations to Columbia County Sheriff David Bartlett. WNYT reported that the initial call for the incident was for, quote, a drunken brawl, unquote. Handy's relatives say he was the victim of a group beating and, quote, he's lucky to be alive, unquote, and that he was placed on a ventilator before being released from Albany Medical Center's trauma ICU on July 6th. Kelly Rosenstrock has been put on leave, but it is unknown if that is paid or unpaid. The sheriff's department is investigating the incident at the house of a sheriff's deputy with aid from the state police. Columbia County Sheriff's Office personnel searched the home on July 7th. Columbia County District Attorney Paul Chazik told the newspaper that the sheriff's office and the state police report to him, quote, on a regular basis, unquote, about the ongoing investigation. Read more about the story in the Columbia paper. This has been the WGXC local news. Go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about this report. The National Weather Service in Albany has issued a heat advisory in effect from 11 a.m. July 19th until 8 p.m. on July 20th. The forecast is sunny and hot on Sunday with a high near 93. Sunday night, it'll still be pretty warm. 72 degrees is the low, and there's a slight chance, a 20% chance of showers or thunderstorms after 2 a.m. Monday, in the morning, there's a 30% chance of rain before 11 a.m. Then it'll turn mostly sunny with a high near 89, low around 63. Tuesday should be mostly sunny with a high of 84 and a low around 65. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, radio for open ears.
Tune in to Quintron's Weather Warlock, a custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizer that turns the changes in the weather into sounds. New Orleans-based artist Quintron installed one of his series of custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizers in the Wavefarm Study Center, with sensors outside detecting the differences and changes in the weather. Here, the precipitation, the sunlight, the wind, and the temperature turned into soundscapes anytime, 24 hours a day, at wavefarm.org/listen, or click on the listen button at any WGXC.org page. One of the many web streams available to listen anytime, Quintron's Weather Warlock, available through Wavefarm.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Galen Joseph Hunter of Acre, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
90.7 FM.
Acre, Hudson, Catskill.
I love books. Do you love books? Books are great. Read more books. Listen to Bound by Books Youth Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM. Hooray!
Welcome, radio listeners. You're listening to Bound by Books Youth Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, and Hudson, listener-supported radio for open ears. I'm Emily. I'm the director of the Hudson Area Library, and I'm from Hudson.
I'm Mishuda, and I'm from Hudson.
I'm Lena. I'm a student of MC Smith.
I'm Fahim. I am 15, and I'm also from Hudson.
I'm Fatia, and I'm 6, and I'm also from Hudson.
Yay! And we're here every week talking about books. Books we love, books we don't love so much, and other bookish things. And we're usually here with our friends Amelia and AJ, but they couldn't join us today, so we'll miss them today. But we're really happy to have Fahim back with us, who we haven't heard from in a bit, and Lena, who we missed last week, and Fatia is back for her second week. And we're always glad to see Mishuda, so that's good too. And I get to see Mishuda and Fahim a lot now because they're both working at the library this summer, so that's really exciting. So that'll be a fun summer working at the library together. But yeah, so let's talk about some books today. Who'd like to get started?
I can start.
Okay.
I would like to share the book Speak by Laurie Hills Anderson. And it's about, a freshman girl. She used to be popular, and she used to have a lot of popular girls who are her friends. And then one day, that one incident changed everything. So she was invited to a party, and she was freshman. And, she was alone in that party. And then a senior boy took advantage of that. He, harassed her, but then she escaped, and she called the police because she freaked out. And now, like, she doesn't speak anymore because, like, she's depressed and she's not, she doesn't trust anyone to share what happened that day. And her friends are confused. Why would she call the police? So, and then her journey goes on from that. So it's a mystery. Will she able to ever speak about what happened? Like, you guys should read that book to find out.
I read that years ago, so I don't remember it as well, but if I'm remembering correctly, in the book, I think you know from the book cover maybe even, or from early on, that she was assaulted at a party, but I don't know if you know the extent of that until partway through the book. I think it kind of, there's maybe flashbacks.
Yeah, there's flashbacks. That night.
And a lot of, it seems like, my memory of it is that a lot of the students don't understand what happened to her, and they just feel like she got them all in trouble. And so she's sort of outcast by her classmates for being the person that got them all in trouble at the party.
Her friend, like at the party, when the friends found out that she called the police, they left her and with their car. And then she was forced to go home alone. She had to like walk the entire bridge and get home. And she was so scared that she didn't even tell her mom. Like, her mom was kept on asking her, like, why did you come home late? And, like, why is your clothes are all messy? Why is your, like, eyeliner smudged? And, but she never said anything. And then she stopped talking because she was, you know, always, you know, happy, talkative. And then after that, but I think that for me, that book gives a message to me. It's like when we are silent, we are actually giving power to the people that harm. And then we're encouraging them to continue their cruelty to us and then others. And Fahim just said that she had PTSD, which I think also the cause.
Yeah, it's a very good book, very powerful. There's also a book that came out maybe a year ago by the same author that's about the author, about her experience writing that book. It's called Shout. I believe it's a memoir in verse. Let's see if it says. It says, in free verse, Anderson shares reflections, rants, and calls to action woven between deeply personal stories from her life that she's never written about before. Searing and soul-searching, this important memoir is a denouncement of our society's failures and a love letter to all the people with the courage to say #MeToo, #TimesUp. Whether aloud, online, or only in their own hearts. Shout speaks truth to power in a loud, clear voice, and once you hear it, it is impossible to ignore. But both books were really great.
Well, Fathia read a book.
You did? What'd you read?
The Rainbow.
So what happened in that book?
So it's super long, by the way.
Just saying, Maria's a rainbow.
Maria the rainbow. So rainbow, and she draw about it.
So the character's name's Maria?
Yeah.
And she drew a rainbow?
She made, like, the color of the rainbow. Yeah, she saw, like, a rainbow outside her window, her window.
Wow, like in the sky?
Yeah.
Like a magical rainbow?
No. A magical rainbow is like much bigger than that.
Yeah, she saw this rainbow which she drew. So Maria was outside of her window and then she saw that rainbow. And then that made her draw pictures on her drawing book that she used to do with her grandma, right?
Yeah.
And then she used 7 colors of the rainbow.
And what's the book called again?
Maria and the Rainbow.
Maria and the Rainbow. Where did you find that book?
We found it on YouTube.
Oh, cool. That seems right in line with Fathia's interest in drawing rainbows. Because Lena missed our show last week, but Fathia shared some of her artwork and some of the books that she's made that have lots of beautiful drawings of rainbows.
Yes, like I have another book.
You have another book?
That time it's going to get like rainbow skin and rainbow toned and everything. That's, it's going to have rainbow people. The skin is going to be rainbow.
Wow, that sounds very creative. I saw a rainbow this weekend. It was right before a big thunderstorm.
You did?
So I went from seeing a rainbow to seeing lightning and thunder and rain.
Outside of your window?
I was out driving, and I would much rather have driven into the rainbow than into the thunderstorm. but I had to get home. So I had to go into the rain. But I like a nice rainbow, and I saw both ends of it. Sometimes you only see one end of it. So does Fahim have a book to talk about?
I don't have a book, but I have a poem.
Okay.
This poem is called The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both. And be one traveler long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could. Where it went in the other world, entered the other as just as fair, having perhaps a better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that passing there, had worn there really about the same. And both the morning equally lay, and leaves no staff had trodden black. Oh, I marked the first for another day, yet knowing how many leads on too late, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverge in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Why'd you choose that one, or where did you find it?
Line.
What did you like about the poem?
It's by Robert Frost. And it just talks about, it's basically like destiny. Do you want to take the right path or do you want to take the wrong path? Mm-hmm. You decide to go with the easiest path, like the hard path or the most difficult path or the simple path.
So my question was, did he took a shortcut instead of doing taking a hard path and, doing the right thing? Did he took a shortcut?
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Okay.
He took the shortest path because he doesn't waste his time in the longest path. Even though the longest path was leading to success.
That's what you think? I take it as he's taking a chance, but he's not just doing something the way everybody else has done. He's taking the one that's less traveled.
Yeah.
Because he's I want to try out something new and maybe see, experience something different and unique. I don't know. Or maybe he's antisocial and he just doesn't want to see anybody. So he's like, nobody goes down this path. I'm going to go down this path.
Or maybe he's just lazy and he doesn't want to, work hard and take the long path. And I don't know, that's what I interpret it.
I guess I haven't read it. I mean, I just heard it, but I haven't read it in a while. I don't remember there being a short and a long path.
Oh, I thought that's what I heard. Okay.
Is there? Maybe there is. I'll have to read it again. I read that poem a lot growing up because Robert Frost was from New Hampshire, which is where I grew up. And I always thought that we read him a lot because he was from New Hampshire, and we probably did. But then I grew up and realized that everybody reads him. It's not just people from New Hampshire.
So. The website that I found the poem, I found there's a picture right next to the poem. Mm-hmm. It's there are two roads, and one is smaller than the other. That's why I was saying he took the shortest path and not the most complicated one. Hmm.
Sometimes the shorter paths turn out to be the most complicated. Because what if there were booby traps on the short path and the long path was just a straight, flat, clean road? What if? But yeah, I think of that poem as taking a chance and trying something new, being brave and unique. That's my reading. But everyone brings their own reading to a poem. So that's the beauty of poetry. Cool. Thanks for sharing, Fahim. Lena, do you have a book to talk about or a bookish thing?
Well, does it count if I talk about a puzzle game? Is it okay? So, this puzzle game is kind of on the electronic device. But basically, this gives you no backstory at all. So, all it shows is a cutscene of you just being washed up on the shore. And basically, you have to figure out why you're at this random island and how to get out of there. And so basically, you're stuck there forever. Just kidding. You have to walk around this island and solve these puzzles, kind of, obviously. But you have to go around this island and yell at these blue box stones. And basically, this strange light leads you to a place. And so basically, once you're done yelling at these stones, you go to a strange place, in the middle of the town place thing. Well, not a town place because there's no one there, but just the island. and you get a fox friend that turns from stone into a fox. And you start chasing after the fox, and I couldn't figure out the next puzzle because I'm trying to find the fox because I'm bad at puzzles, so like I'll just leave you on a cliffhanger, and that's it.
Are you on a cliffhanger until you figure it out, or have you given up figuring it out?
Oh, until I figure it out.
Okay, so it's not an eternal cliffhanger, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully, but I've been trying for ages to solve this puzzle.
What kind of puzzles are they?
Well, like, usually they're puzzles of, like, where is the statue? And the first puzzle they give you is, how do you get past the boar? Because, like, there's a boar blocking the way to the first statue ever in the game. And then you figure out that there's a bush and you throw a fruit from the bush on the ground. But basically, the puzzle that I'm trying to solve is, how do you find the fox? And how do I yell at these three statues at the same time? But it's mostly trying to find the fox right now.
I hope you find him.
I hope so too. And if they give us a name option for the fox, I know what to name the fox. Swipe or no swiping.
Of course. What's the name of the game?
It's called Rhyme.
Like R-H-Y-M-E, like rhyming? Or
no, like R-I-M-E.
Does that mean something or does it not tell you?
Oh, now I need to search that up on Google now. Now I need to know if it means something. Like if I put it in translate, will it mean a word?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was like the name of a place or a character or something.
We don't know the character's name. Also, there's some strange person in a red cloak who is mysterious and who you can't see. We have many theories of who it might be, but I still need to figure out the puzzle. Because without the fox, I'm stuck in this place. Also, did I mention that I need to figure out how to get past all the ruins? Basically, you're on an old island where there are no people. I'm very confused because they didn't even give you like anything like breaking it down.
That sounds fun.
It is.
Well, I hope you keep making progress. It's fun to fun to solve that stuff. It's less fun to be stuck.
Yeah.
Well, I could talk about a book. I recently read a book called Stand Up, Yumi Chung. And it's by Jessica Kim. And it's about a young woman named Yumi Chung, who is Korean-American, and her family runs a Korean barbecue restaurant in Koreatown in Los Angeles. And she dreams of becoming a stand-up comedian, hence the title Stand Up, Yumi Chung. And she loves watching YouTube videos and Netflix specials on stand-up. And her favorite person is someone named Jasmine Jones. And she really wants to go to summer camp, to a comedy camp. But her parents have decided that she needs to take a tutoring class over summer so that she can pass a test and get into a fancy private school so that she can get a good education and then get a good job and be able to support herself and her family. But she really wants to go to this comedy camp, but she's not allowed to go. And then one day she's walking around and she sees a theater where there's a sign up that has her favorite comedian, Jasmine Jones, on it. And then she hears Jasmine's voice and she walks into the theater, and it turns out that Jasmine Jones is offering a workshop in stand-up comedy. And when she walks in, she's just, you know, in awe of this comedian that she loves so much. And then the people there mistake her for somebody that was signed up for the program that didn't show up, named Kay Nakamura. So she doesn't correct them because she's like, oh, I get to take part in this camp or this workshop. So she starts doing both going to the tutoring program, but then also going to this workshop and pretending to be someone named Kei Nakamura, which is a Japanese name, not a Korean name. So she's pretending to be another person from a different background. And so as you might guess from reading or watching stories or just from life itself, when you're lying to people in your life, it gets complicated. So she's both lying to her fellow workshop members and to Jasmine Jones, who she idolizes. And then she's also lying to her family about what she's doing. So, you know, those things are bound to catch up with you. But it has an interesting and nice resolution to it, where, you know, she stands up for who she is and for the people who care about her and stands up for herself and does some stand-up. So it's pretty fun. I liked it a lot. It was a cute middle grade chapter book, and it was light. It's good to have a light read now and again.
You have to lie once, then you have to lie, like, to keep up with that one lie that you, like, you have to do more lies. You have to, which is complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like especially when you're pretending to be someone that you're not, it means that you can't really share your full self with people. So that's challenging.
I can't imagine, like, how it's like the parents and also the comedian's reaction is going to be. I'm thinking, in my opinion, like, at first, they won't be that much understanding. They won't be understanding. But then if she stands up for herself, like, explains it to them, like, I'm thinking then they will understand. Because does she want to be a comedian? Is that her passion?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does anyone have a good joke? I don't have any good jokes. I have some favorite jokes, but no, none of them are very good. And half the time I say them wrong, so I'm not going to say one. But do you have any good jokes?
I just thought, what do people wear when it's tea time?
When it's tea time? Oh, a t-shirt?
Tea time.
Oh, what time?
No, sea time.
Tea time?
Sea time. Not what's tea time.
Sea time? What's sea time?
Yeah. Sea time.
A mask.
Venting mask.
But what's sea time?
You mean COVID.
Okay. Oh, COVID time? Okay.
Oh. What is mostly COVID? I don't know those words.
She doesn't know COVID. It's a virus.
Venting virus. I already know what about
virus. Yeah, she
So my joke was about, like the rainbow, like, was, like, a, like, the big giant fucking rainbow was, like, going to, like, destroy the world, and then other rainbows disturb him, and then jump at the bus, and, like, get the bus and throw at him, and, like, put some spells and ate it.
That's goofy. Fahim, do you want to tell a joke?
Yeah, I have a joke. What's the best thing about Switzerland? I don't know, but the flag is a big plus.
That's a good one. Flag humor. I like flag humor. I don't know much flag humor, but I like that one.
Miss Emily, I have another joke.
Okay.
Why do we tell actors to break a leg? Because every play has a cast.
Oh. Lena, do you have any jokes?
Yeah. So a plane is about to crash. The pilot says there are only 3 parachutes left. And then the president says, I need to go because I have a country to run. And then the president jumps off the plane. There's a doctor who says, I have lives to save, and jumps out of the plane. Then there's a father who says, son, I think you should take the last parachute because I have lived a long, fulfilling life. And the son says, don't worry, the president took my backpack.
Ha ha. That poor president.
I have another.
Okay.
Why do people call a balloon a balloon?
I don't know.
Looks like a balloon.
Because it's bloated.
How did we
pick this one? Miss Emily, I have another joke.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's a doctor and a patient. The doctor said, I have some bad news and some very bad news. The lab called with your test results. They said you have 24 hours to live. The patient says, 24 hours? That's terrible. What's the very bad news? And the doctor said, I've been trying to reach you since yesterday.
Oh, no. Poor patient.
Anyways, we're about out of time. It was nice talking with you all. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We hope everyone has a great week and reads lots of good books or poems or plays some puzzle games or makes books.
I'm going to do boat.
Okay. That sounds like a plan. That sounds like a good week. Well, have a good week. Happy reading.
Bye. Bye.
I know I can hold on.
This is Tom Rowe with the WGXC Local News. Go to the newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about anything in these stories. The village of Kinderhook announced July 17th that all organized rallies or protests will first require organizers to seek the permission of village officials. Quote, as of today, the village of Kinderhook is requiring that all uses of the village square require the submission of an application for the use of village property, unquote. Dunham wrote in an email to village residents. Prior approval is needed to avoid conflicts with, quote, previously approved uses of the village square, unquote, including the Saturday Farmers Market, Mayor James Dunham said. Kinderhook Village Square was the scene of a Black Lives Matter rally July 11th and a Black the Blue rally June 18th, organized by resident Alex Rosenstrock. Dunham said the village has always put state police and the Columbia County Sheriff's Office on notice about planned events, but there was, quote, never a need, unquote, for law enforcement until two white residents of the village brandished their firearms at participants in a July 11th rally. Quote, this is to keep things safe and peaceful, unquote, he said. Nora Mishniak is reporting for Columbia Green Media that a rally organized in support of a man alleged to have been severely beaten at a party in Kinderhook July 4th has been canceled. The planned event was scheduled to take place in the village square, but was canceled at the request of the man's family, village clerk Nicole Heater said July 17th. The man, Harold Handy, a local auto mechanic, was the victim of a brutal assault that allegedly took place at the Kinderhook residence of Club Life and Fitness owner Alex Rosenstrock. Following the execution of a search warrant at Rosenstrock's home, the Columbia County Sheriff's Office subsequently announced that Deputy Kelly Briscoe Rosenstrock, Alex's wife, was placed on administrative leave effective July 9th. Sheriff's Office spokesperson Lieutenant Louis Bray said July 17th, quote, the investigation is very active. Alongside the state police, we are working very hard to conclude this investigation as soon as possible and as thoroughly as possible, unquote. Bray declined further comment, except to say that, quote, nothing has changed, unquote, with respect to the Sheriff's Department July 9th press release denying that any other deputy sheriffs were present at the party at the time of the incident other than Kelly. State police likewise have consistently denied that any state police personnel were present at the gathering that night. Quote, there were no state troopers at the residence, period, unquote, State Police Director of Public Information Bo Duffy said. The Sheriff's Office remains the lead agency investigating the assault, with assistance from the State Police Special Investigations Unit, Duffy said, although he failed to provide the number of state police actually involved in the probe. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. The Times Union is reporting that five area healthcare systems have been awarded almost $17.5 million in federal funds designed to help the facilities prosper as they deal with the public health and financial impact of the coronavirus pandemic. U.S. Senators Charles Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand said July 18th. The awards announced Columbia Memorial Hospital in Hudson $4.5 million, Albany Medical Center $5.64 million, St. Peter's Hospital in Albany $2.95 million, Sunnyview Rehabilitation Hospital in Schenectady $2.55 million, and Nathan Litterer Hospital in Gloversville $1.85 million. The senator said 86 New York hospitals will receive more than $680 million of the new $10 billion allocation designated for so-called hotspot hospitals. Hospitals are strained financially, losing hundreds of millions of dollars a month because of canceled elective procedures, increased staffing and overtime costs, and expanded bed capacity and increased spending on supplies and equipment, Schumer noted. Read more about this story in the Times Union. And the Local Journalism Sustainability Act has been introduced in the U.S. House by U.S. Representatives Ann Kirkpatrick of Arizona and Dan Newhouse of Washington, an effort to help preserve community journalism nationwide. With the industry already facing financial difficulties before the COVID-19 emergency, the subsequent economic consequences of the pandemic now have local journalism facing numerous challenges to remain sustainable. The Local Journalism Sustainability Act offers a series of three categories for tax credits. The first credit would incentivize annual subscriptions to local papers that primarily produce content related to local news and current events. It could also be used for nonprofit publications. The second credit is a 5-year refundable credit for local newspapers to employ and adequately compensate journalists. The last of the three credits is a 5-year non-refundable tax credit that would induce small to medium-sized businesses to advertise with local newspapers, as well as local radio and television stations. If signed into law, the measure would also encourage Americans to subscribe to local publications, help those publications retain and compensate journalists, and provide businesses and publications alike with much-needed advertising dollars. The proposed legislation has already gained the support of leaders in the media and newspaper industries, including the News Media Alliance, America's Newspapers, and the National Newspaper Association. This has been the WGXC Local News. Go to the newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
It's Catherine Gallagher with Hudson Mohawk Magazine here with Kathy Manley, who is the legal director for the Coalition for Civil Freedoms. So first of all, what is the Coalition for Civil Freedoms?
So hi, thanks for having me. The Coalition for Civil Freedoms was founded in 2010 by people who were unfairly treated in the war on terror with domestic prosecution. And we advocate for those people. We have a database of over 1,000 cases of people who were prosecuted not because of anything they did, but because after 9/11, the government started doing what we call preemptive prosecution. They tried to go after people who hadn't done anything out of a fear that they might someday do something. And it's basically following the Dick Cheney statement that if there's a 1% chance that somebody might attack us, we have to take them down now and be preemptive. He was talking about preemptive war, but it's the same model that the FBI has been following since 9/11. And so we advocate for those people. There's over 200 who are currently incarcerated that we feel are either unfairly convicted or sentenced overly harshly, usually both. And so we advocate for them in various ways, and we also work with their families a lot. And so we have family conferences every year. Unfortunately, this year it looks like it'll be virtual because it's a pandemic, but we bring together family members. Those have been growing and have been really empowering for the family members to get together and support each other and figure out how to best advocate for their loved ones, how to deal with the media, how to deal with lobbying, a lot of things like that. As legal director, I deal with a lot of the prisoners. I try to help them with issues that come up in the prisons because a lot of times the Bureau of Prisons or particular guards treat them extra harshly because they say, oh, you're a terrorist, you're evil, you know, and write them up for unfair violations, or there's a lot of religious discrimination. Sometimes they're not allowed to have the Quran, which is their right to have. There's a lot of issues with medical care, so I try to deal with all these things. They're all very difficult. I also sometimes file in court for people, which is what we've been doing lately with compassionate release motion. And occasionally, for other reasons, I file in court. But most of it is dealing with the prisoners directly and trying to better their prison conditions. We have published 2 reports based on our database explaining how most of the cases that the government calls terrorists are not really terrorists, that they never actually did anything, that they were either unfair sting operations targeting vulnerable people, or they were unfair convictions of material support for terrorism where there was no proof of intent to support violence, or they were unfair conspiracy charges, basically guilt by association, or other unfair tactics that the government uses. We also drafted a bill, which isn't getting anywhere yet, but maybe someday it will, to try to remedy these, because the law is really terrible with these kinds of cases. They can be manipulated by the informant to the point where they weren't going to do anything before, but the informant talks them into agreeing to do something in a fake case. So we wanted to change the law on that and say they have to already be taking steps in that direction.
So just to go back a little bit, what does it mean to be granted compassionate release?
It's really good timing that there was a bill passed called the First Step Act. It became law in 2019. Before that, compassionate release meant that the Bureau of Prisons could grant a motion for somebody if they were terminally ill. And even then, they didn't grant the motion. So most people died waiting for that compassionate release to be granted. So under the First Step Act, the judge has to find an extraordinary and compelling reason. And it can be based on serious medical conditions for people over 65, which are chronic conditions that are not going to improve, that make life more difficult for you in prison. They have to find that. And then they also have to show that you're not a danger to the public. It can really be for any reason, as we discovered, not just medical reasons, any extraordinary and compelling reason.
So how has the coronavirus pandemic changed the process or the amount of compassionate release forms requested?
Yeah, it's been a huge change because the CDC has made it clear that when people are over a certain age and you have certain medical conditions, you're particularly vulnerable to the virus. and you have a much greater risk of severe complications or death. And then the coronavirus started spreading in prisons, and we started a coronavirus release project. What we did was we took our list of 200 prisoners that we support, and we looked to see who on that list was over 60. And then we started writing to them and saying, you know, if they have any of these medical conditions or even based on their age, that we could file this motion for them. And so only one of ours so far got granted, and several got denied, and we still have one pending, and we are working on preparing about three more, and there may be more coming. But we have a pretty limited capacity because I'm here doing this part-time. It's basically a full-time job, but luckily we have this other attorney, Ahmed, who's been working on it, and I have my intern, who is actually Yasin Arif's son, and he's a Harvard Law student. He's my intern for the summer.
So the coronavirus has clearly impacted the compassionate release process, but how has it impacted the prison system?
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, it started out slow. You can look at a graph and it gets very steep pretty quickly as far as the number of cases. And then there's been 95 deaths in federal prison. And our people, two of them, well, one of them named Mohammed Yusuf, we didn't consider him for a motion because he was young and he was in Lompoc federal prison in California, and he contracted the virus. It was spreading like wildfire there, and in the event, he got really sick. They just threw him in solitary on a tier with other people in solitary, I guess, and he died while he was still in his cell. They found him dead, and then later we heard that other prisoners on that tier had heard him gasping for breath and begging for help and yelled, and they had banged on the bars and screamed for guards to help him get him to the ER. They did nothing. But it's just so horrible. He was supposed to get out next year. He had been locked up for quite a while. So he died, and I think that his original attorney may be pursuing a lawsuit since we discovered that all these other prisoners had tried to get the attention of the guards, and they had to know that he was suffering and that they just did nothing. The other person is Ibrahim El-Gabrouni, and he was in federal prison in Elkton. He'd been locked up since 1993, even pre-9/11, on an unfair sting operation case, and was supposed to get out next year. And he was older and more vulnerable, and I had written to him about doing a motion and had never heard back. And I guess that is because he had already contracted the virus and he became very ill. He's been on a ventilator since April. I don't think there's really any real hope of him coming back from that at this point. It's really, really sad. So it's impacted our people, with those two people in particular. And I mean, we're hoping to get people released from it, and that's sort of the silver lining, but it's a really dangerous disease, and it's really difficult in prison because it's impossible to social distance, so it spreads really fast, and the prisons are not always honest about reporting it, and they don't do much testing. They only test if you have symptoms, so it's a really difficult situation.
You've talked about these two individuals in particular, but have you been working with any one group more than others in terms of compassionate release or coronavirus in the prisons?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have our list of 200 people that, you know, we were looking at trying to help for those who are particularly vulnerable to the virus, but sometimes people die of it without any of those criteria, so it's kind of a wild card. As far as in the prison, I mean, there's certain prisons that have more and more cases than others. But now, as with the country as a whole, it's gone from like New York, California, et cetera, to everywhere else, especially in the South and the West. And that's how it gets into the prisons, is almost always from the guards that live in that community where there's a lot of cases, and then they go into the prison and they infect the prisoners, and it's impossible to social distance in prison. There's nothing they can do to protect themselves, especially in low security prisons where people are gonna get out sooner, you know, considered less dangerous. Those are the prisons where it spreads the fastest because there's a lot more contact between inmates and guards, particularly between inmates, and they don't do the testing. So it's a threat to everybody in prison, really. But, you know, certain groups are more vulnerable and certain prisons are more vulnerable.
Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you.
This is Peter Sergey, arts correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And today I'm joined by Michaela Foster, an organizer for All of Us, a Schenectady organization that's been doing a lot of protests against police brutality in the area. So how are you, Michaela?
I'm feeling very well today, actually. in light of recent events in Schenectady, I feel more motivated now than ever, I think.
Could you tell us a bit about what has happened since the July 4th Pride protest?
So the Pride protest was set up to not only commemorate Stonewall and the history of organizing against police brutality for Pride, for justice, and for liberation within New York State, because a lot of people overlook the fact that that did happen in New York State, but also to push forward the demands of the people currently within the Capital District, specifically Schenectady. So our 13 demands, authored by organizers within all of us, but language taken from and demands coming from the citizens of Schenectady and the community and what they've been asking for. We've put those out into the public. We've made it a survey. We've done, you know, petitions and stuff like that. And we have overwhelming support from a great majority of our community. And yet our chief of police, assistant chief of police, and mayor still refuse to meet those demands. That has been what's been happening since July 4th. So we have set out on not only our freedom tour, all of us is working in coalition with Vocal New York and a couple other organizing groups to send the message that we are going to bring our people home, those incarcerated people who are just being brutalized behind bars. But we've also set out to have our demands met, our 13 demands, which is honestly just the bare minimum. I mean, these 13 demands are based solely around the criminal justice system. That's not where all of us begins or ends, but that is our focus currently due to recent events. So we've begun our plan in occupying Schenectady. We've held one civil disobedience training and protest in the past couple days, and we intend to continue in that direction as our demands continue to not be met. As the chief of police and the mayor have continued to choose the side of inaction, and inaction and silence is the side of the oppressor against those who are oppressed, we will continue to fight for our demands to be met. That's really what's going on, specifically with all of us organizing in Schenectady. We have support from Saratoga, Glens Falls, Rotterdam, Niskayuna, organizers in those areas as well. They show up for us, we show up for them, especially Albany. And they're all signed on to with the 13 demands and a push within their own communities. Those 13 demands really signify, like, it's not that hard to just sign a piece of paper, as opposed to arresting or brutalizing or ignoring the demands of hundreds and hundreds of people.
So I'd also like to ask how you specifically got into organizing. Like, what was the impetus, the catalyst?
So I was homeschooled. I love telling this story. I was homeschooled from kindergarten to fifth grade, and I was raised with incredible parents. Contrary to popular belief, Jamaica Miles and Sean Young are not my actual parents. They might as well be, but they're not. My actual parents are super cool, and they raised me on the principles of, you know, liberation and equity, and really gave me so much free space to explore the eccentric aspects of my personality and identity as it changed and developed and reshaped so often. So coming from a really free home situation and upbringing, right around junior year in high school, and I mean, they took me to events all the time, community cleanups, marches, you know, peaceful protests, all that stuff. But right around my junior year, the end of my junior year in high school, a lot of stuff was happening geared around Black Lives Matter, and I took it upon myself to start having some protests. So me and a couple other younger members of the community, specifically Black women, banded together and started doing protests. And I said, you know what, I think that there needs to be something more than this. So I actually started a group called Young and Empowered in Schenectady around 2016, 2017. And it was based around specifically young Black women doing the work for justice and liberation for young Black and brown people, young Black and brown queer people,